And you know me too well, know me too well. Know me too well. But then again, I might be revealing all I can tell, all I can tell. Honey, all I can tell. Well, I've loved, stolen, cheated, I lied and I lost, so what the hell, baby? In what I believe yourself. Go on and believe in yourself. We got a billion miles left to go, and I should kick myself today. But then the planet starts to roll. Well, yesterday's gone, tomorrow is today. White picket fence.
White picket fence.
I said, please look after my soul and spiritual recompense. My recompense. My recompense. He spent our gold, silver, nickels, our dollars and dimes on self-defense. Well, his own self-defense. Then he whistled and smiled and said, I'm off to Switzerland and France. Switzerland and Switzerland and France. Still got a billion miles left to go, and I should kick myself today. Then the planet starts to roll. Yesterday's gone, tomorrow is today. In your brain, buzzing in your brain. Gonna leave this here like Johnny Appleseed. Forget my name, forget my name. Well, please forget my name. Still got a billion miles left to go, and I should kick myself today. Then the planet starts to roll. Yesterday's gone.
Bring on the night with Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
You can advertise your business on Night Dreams Talk Radio, and you will be heard worldwide. Why not contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com? The views, opinions, and representations expressed on the Night Dreams Talk Radio Network and its website are those of the hosts, guests, and participants, and are not necessarily those of or endorsed by the network, its affiliated stations and broadcasts, the management, other hosts, or advertisers of the network. The shows found on the Night Dreams Talk Radio Network can, but do not necessarily, promote any particular lifestyle, belief, religion, political affiliation, or other personal practice. These shows are for entertainment purposes only and are not intended to treat, diagnose, and or claim any cure of disease or condition or give any medical or legal advice. Coming to you from some far point station, like a cosmic tumbleweed, both north and south of the Pleiades, here's your host, Gary Anderson.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, depending on your time zone. I hope everybody's having a good one. I know we are. Well, tonight we got a great show. Our first guest will be Stephen Bassett. And then we have, well, another guest at the, well, for an hour, Stephen Starr. And we're going to talk about what the world would be like in a nuclear holocaust. and what would be left of our planet and how we would survive if we could. It's going to be a really great show here tonight. Well, in California, a young couple leaves their sliding door open as they go to the supermarket. They forget to close it. Well, they come back about an hour and a half later, and they notice somebody is sleeping on their couch. When they look a little bit closer, it isn't somebody, it's a giant bear. James, I tell you what, those bears just like making themselves at home, don't they?
They do. I'll tell you, I miss those bear stories that used to come in and wreck people's garages and houses and drink their beer, but I guess they're back in the news again.
I know. Well, it's that time of year. They're looking for a nice place to hibernate. And, you know, what's wrong with a couch and, you know, maybe sitting back and, well, watching, you know, reruns with Married and Children or something. I don't know. But I tell you, I wouldn't want to come home. And how would you get the bear out of your house? That would be the, you know, you're going to call 911 and say, hey, I got a bear laying on my couch. Can you come and get it out? I don't know how the couch would even survive.
Exactly. What would you do? These are good questions. It reminds me of the snakes and the bears and all these other animals that are encroaching on our, our environment.
Well, look at this, too. You know what? Like last year, you know what? Like the bear went into somebody's garage and they had a refrigerator in the garage and it was stacked full of beer. And the bear just drank every can of beer that was in that refrigerator. And when they got home, guess what? They had a drunk, passed out bear.
They did. I remember seeing a picture of that bear was just laid out flat on his back and beer. It looked like it was just wrecked the place and drunken bear. It was amazing.
Yeah. Can you imagine the hangover that bear would have had?
I bet it was a bear of a hangover, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Imagine dealing with that.
I wouldn't want to. You know, I can tell you one thing. Hey, we had company. It was a bear. Anyway, we'll be back with our first guest, Stephen Bassett. So hang on. We'll be right back. So stay tuned.
We're here to make you feel
better. Hi, Tom Davis here with Metatron Power and Light. We'd like to thank everyone for all the positive emails and responses to our music. Our music can be found on Amazon, Spotify, YouTube, and all digital outlets, and is featured on Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
Metatron Power and Light is a band that deals with esoteric subjects, the paranormal, and other topics that engage the spirit and mind. Visit MetatronPowerAndLight.com to learn more.
We are facing a time of great change, and the future is unwritten. But when we come together and seek answers, we expand our awareness until we begin to see the unseen. Uncovering secrets allows us to develop the knowledge we will need to shape our future and control our destiny.
Night Dreams Talk Radio, After Dark, wants to give a big shout out to all the truckers that listen to our show.
From the compound in beautiful Gig Harbor, Washington, Night Dreams Talk Radio presents your host, Gary Anderson.
And that is me. But don't forget, in January the 15th, we're going full syndication. Right now, we're on 14 stations across the country. But in January, we're going to be going on well over 100 stations across the country. So not just the internet, not just watching us on YouTube now with our new channel, you'll be able probably to pick us up all across the country. So you truckers out there, you can just kind of tune in and listen to the show. Well, James, who's our first guest?
Oh, boy, our first guest tonight is Mr. Stephen Bassett. Now, he is a political activist, and he is also the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. Now, Stephen has done countless documentaries over the years and lectures, all in the pursuit of disclosure.
Well, Stephen, welcome back to the show, my friend. It's been, about a month or two since we had you on. How are you doing?
Ah, the time just flies during the pandemic, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know about that. I guarantee you I've watched every episode of Gunsmoke in the last year and a half. And that was 20 years worth.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, but I mean, when you start watching it for the third time, you know, each episode, it kind of is not as fun anymore. So what is going on out there nowadays and with disclosure and conferences and all that stuff?
Well, there is a lot happening, but it's getting more and more complicated. This has been a very unusual time in American history. If you're an activist, then that matters. Most people are doing things which don't necessarily are not necessarily affected by this political development or that political development. But when you're an activist on a big issue, you're affected by anything along those lines. So we're in a strange place. And I'm sure your listeners were thinking, okay, well, what's going on? What are you doing that it matters how strange the place is? And I get that. I've been honing my message. I've been doing a lot of interviews this year. This is my 112th, I think, in 2021. And I'm honing the message, and so let me give you the quick message about why I do what I do and what's going on. It's actually fairly straightforward, but it might surprise some people. I have a couple of fundamentals that are why I get up in the morning and do what I do without any hesitation. The first one is that based on everything that I'm aware of and watch and have seen, and I do pay some a close attention, we're headed for a nuclear war. We almost had one on a number of occasions over the last 75 years. How many is not clear, easily five or six. A couple of these are sort of well known, and it's like we didn't have it. So people go, wow, okay, great. Isn't that wonderful? Well, how many times can you spin the thing in the gun, you know, playing Russian roulette before you finally shoot yourself? So we are in a very, very risky situation now, and it's not being discussed. It's not being addressed. It's almost normal, meaning, hey, nuclear war risk is greater than it's ever been. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists confirmed that just a number of few months ago when they moved the clock to 100 seconds to midnight, which is nuclear war. There's rumor they may move it even closer come December. New weapons are turning up. They're mentioned in the news, and we go on. No talks of nuclear arms limitations, nothing. Lots of hostility, lots of saber rattling. The fact is, we're going to have a nuclear war. And I doubt we can get through 20 more years. So that's not a good thing. That would be bad. All right. So that gets me up in the morning. Now, what's the second thing? All right. What can we do about it? I mean, I'm actually interested in what we can do about it. I'd love to know what all the politicians on Capitol Hill in Washington would like to do. They didn't even talk about it anymore. They have other things more important to deal with. Really?
Yeah.
We don't have many options. The circumstances right now are that we really have no significant plan. There's very little going on, but the risks are going up on a monthly basis. And so essentially, the things we should be doing, we're not. So, okay, that sounds pretty bleak, right? We're not doing enough. We're not really addressing the issue. It's practically inevitable. Okay, what's the third thing that gets me up in the morning? There may be a way around this. There may be a way out of this mess. And it's not an accident. It involves the extraterrestrials. And there's no, there's no accident here. This is tied together. This is how I perceive it. This is my analysis. It wasn't simply a coincidence that there was a huge explosion or increase in activity in our skies, creating many sightings back in 47, a year or so after the bombs were dropped on Japan. activity of the ET since then has been scrutinized fairly well, as best we can. And there's one thing that stands out among all other things. It's the most important thing we know about ETs. And we know a lot. There's a lot of evidence. But the single most important thing that we know and should be out there and discussed above all else is that extraterrestrials, starting in the 1960s, started turning our weapons off, our nuclear weapons off. They started turning the Soviet weapons off. This is called nuclear weapons tampering. I think that's my phrase. It's also called UFOs and nukes, but I don't like that phrase. Nuclear weapons tampering. So, okay, that's a big deal that they're doing that. It's a big deal that we know that. It's a big deal that the government won't address it or even talk about it, by and large. So where do we go from there? Well, the first thing you do, knowing these three things, is you ask yourself, if they're turning our weapons off, why are they doing it? It's an absolutely legitimate question. They've done it many times in the U.S., Soviet Union, and in Russia. They've actually done it recently, we believe. There's reasonable evidence they've done it not too long ago, not too many years ago. But they started in the mid-60s. It's just not, what the hell? They got nothing to do. And they figure, well, it's boring. There's nothing happening, right? There's nothing on cable. Well, let's go turn some nukes off. Of course not. That question, why do they turn nukes off, is the most important question in the world today. Why? Because I believe the reason that they turn them off may be the answer to our existential problem. How are we going to avoid a nuclear war, which is practically inevitable under the current protocols? Okay, now, how would this work out? How would it go? And my assessment is this, and I can't wait to find out if I'm right or wrong. This isn't just my assessment. There are others that have very similar views, particularly the witnesses to these events. And there are many witnesses to these events of turning off weapons. Is that these are actions designed to inform us that these weapons are really stupid things to have. It's not a threat. It's not, don't fool with us. We can turn your nukes off. They can melt them down. There's a lot of things they could do. They don't need them. They don't need to send a threatening message like that. We can't threaten them, and we know that. Our government knows that. But the message is, why in the hell do you have these nukes? That you can't use them against us, at least not now, and all you can do is destroy yourself. So we turn them off, and you turn them back on. We turn them off again, you turn them back on. On a couple of occasions, they've turned them on, which means they set them into launch mode, which is a whole different technological equation to solve, but they're able to do it. And so you've got missile silo guys running around like crazy with the nukes moving forward in the launch secrets. They didn't turn the keys. They've also done this in the Soviet Union, absolutely scaring them to death. And then very close to when they might actually launch, they turn back off. Now that's many times more frightening and a much bigger message than turning them off. Again, the message is clearly, why do you have these nukes? Okay, good. Now, some people have concluded from this that part of that message is, yeah, these things are dangerous. We can turn them off and on. And by the way, if you launch them, we'll take care of that for you. We'll turn them off in the sky or something, or we'll blow them up. Or don't worry, we'll never let a nuclear war take place. That is not a justified conclusion, and is, I think, highly unlikely that that is the case. And that if we depend on ETs to intervene in some mistake where we actually launch these weapons, this would be, well, the height of stupidity. It would be about as stupid as you can get as a civilization. So I'm going to assume they're not going to do that. All right, so where does this go then? Why are the ETs still here? Why are they constantly being seen? Why is it ever, are we approaching the inevitable disclosure event where the confirmation of ET presence will be formalized by governments and everybody will know. Where is this leading? What is the point of all this? There has to be a point. This, again, is not casual. It's not what the hell. It's there's a very significant thing going on here. With the ETs, I think there's a couple of things going on, but the new thing is the most important of all. Where is it going? And usually when I get done my little lecture, I conclude this way. The plan all along, after we dropped those nukes on Japan, was to help assist and push us forward towards acknowledgement of their presence, formal acknowledgement, which I came to call disclosure with a capital D. The disclosure with a small d had been out and being used in the subject matter, but I put a capital D in front of it and called it the event. Pushing us toward disclosure, helping us get there by their very presence and activity and everything that they do. Meaning they expect us to do this. They do not want to force it on us. Okay, fine. So they're helping us get to disclosure along with the activists and everybody else that's been trying to get this issue out all these years. And so, okay, fine. So what happens if we get it? What happens if the President of the United States discloses late this year, early next year, which is very, very possible? We can talk about that later. Okay, well, then the announcement is out. The confirmation is there. The world learns that there's an ET presence. Okay, what happens after that? It's a reasonable question. Massive interest in the subject by billions of people. Huge pressure on all nations to start coming forward with information and declassifying materials and possibly research programs and whatever, plus a complete and total review of all research done prior, all the books reread, a lot of people going, oh yeah, you had it right, sorry that I ridiculed you. Huge amounts of that. In other words, a massive, intense engagement of the issue by virtually the entire planet that could go on for, it probably in a year, it would be pretty intense and substantial, but 2 years certainly, given the ability to transmit information and access information. Okay, now the world is like not only aware that there's an ET presence, but has like reviewed all the material and is like everybody knows quite a bit about this issue. Certainly all the governments and all the agencies and so forth and so forth. Then what? Open contact. Oh, open contact. Yeah, because once the world has been made aware of the ET presence, once the world has had a chance to learn an enormous amount about it at every level, academic, average person in the street, everybody, even kids, whatever, so that it's, well, it's standard, it's normal. Yeah, they're here and we know a bunch. ETs could then be an open engagement with us without a lot of drama, without a lot of trauma. Open contact. What is that? Open contact is ETs dealing with governments directly. And us being informed of what the discussions are, what is going on.
Yeah, but I got to ask you a question, Stephen. Mm-hmm. Can you trust, and would you trust, beings we know nothing about? And we don't really know what their motives could actually be.
Well, the only way to find out what their motives are is to get into discussions with them.
Yeah.
So we have to get to open contact to have any chance of learning what is the reason for their presence? What is the reason why they have been turning our nukes off? And we may find out why they put crop circles down and what they're doing with cows. It's probably almost certainly has to do with cow blood, which happens to be very similar to human blood. And I'm curious to know about that. But the one thing we need to know, and we hopefully will find out very quickly after open contact takes place, which could happen as soon as 2023, is why you turn off the news. I think I know the answer, and I'm happy to put that out there.
What is it?
Place your bets, right? The answer is this. We're now in open contact with you because you have nuclear weapons, but that's not the only reason. We've been around a long time. This is not our first rodeo. So we're pretty much aware of your scientific and technological status. We're aware of where your technology is going and your science and so forth. The science and physics is the same throughout the entire universe. And we are also quite aware that you are closing in on the answer to interstellar travel. Warp drive. in our movies, we're there. I mean, we've been flying around the universe and the galaxy for some time now, and warp drive and ships of all types and movies and fantastic CGI. But our physics is actually starting to get close. This is not hard to find out. Just start browsing the internet, do some Googling, and you'll discover programs that are underway. You'll see some theories. And I'm not talking about crazy physicists working in their garage in Belarus. I'm talking about real programs that are starting to formulate the answer to the workaround of relativity. That means we're going to have starships, and soon, easily before the end of the century. Frankly, I think we'll have interstellar starships, assuming we don't have a nuclear war, by 2050.
And yeah, so, but here's, okay, here's the other thing. Are we going to be here? You know,
again, if we have a nuclear war, it's pointless. But let's
not even
don't.
This that though, Stephen. You know, yeah. I had Captain Paul Watson, and I know I've thrown up his name a lot on the show lately. He's coming back on. You know, yeah. And Whale Wars. I don't know if you remember that on
cable. Sure, I remember it well.
And what he said, what people are in denial, what is going on in our oceans. Sure. You know, the plankton is dying big time.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I know.
If
I know.
That dies, we die.
But let me point out something to your listeners that I really want to get across to them.
Go ahead.
All right. I mean, I'm aware of the damage that's being done. I'm aware of the fact that 7 billion people is probably 4 or 5 billion too many. And I'm aware that we're going through what is almost certainly a warming trend, leading to a wet trend or a wet period, which will be massively destructive to civilization unless we come up with a way to deal with it. All right. I'm aware of that. But let me be clear. Long before you're going to find yourself up to your chin in water in Florida, long before all the forests have burned down because of extreme heat from global warming, it you'll be dead. In other words, the nuclear war could happen tomorrow. Global warming and most of its effects are still well down the line. And so we're driving ourselves crazy in political debates and angst and everything over global warming and rising waters and forest fires and so forth and all the things we have to do and how much it's going to cost. And we're virtually not doing anything, certainly as citizens. It's not even in play in town meetings. It's not in play in the campaigns. It doesn't come up in the debates, even for president. We're doing nothing about the fact that we're on the edge of nuclear war every single day. So I understand about global warming and everything, but trust me, folks, that's not the big problem.
Well, you know,
that is nothing. The nuclear war is the problem. That's what we have to address. If we don't address the nuclear problem, I assure you global warming will be irrelevant.
Well, you know what I see every day, we're kind of like pushing several different countries to try to flex our power. And, yeah, and we got NATO involved in it. And what we are doing is pushing a group of couple countries to hate us all the more. And they have grouped together, Russia and China, you know, are really gotten bonded in the last year or so. Really
close. A lot of things are happening.
Scary.
Are happening, Gary. And so when I say we're getting close, and nuclear war is inevitable, it's based upon all of these things. We're doing stuff. China's doing stuff. Russia's doing stuff. We're not dealing with the less developed countries. There's massive unrest developing. There's genocide. There's suffering people, starvation, whatever. All of this is creating instability and pressure in a world where there are still about 10 countries that have nuclear weapons. We have enough stockpiles to destroy the planet many times over, and we're making even better weapons still, and we're on the verge of taking weapons into space. And every effort to get a treaty there has gone nowhere for 40 years. So again, you can pick one, or you know, we can point at this and that and everything else. And people say, well, look, if we could just identify the 47 or the top 50 variables here that is keeping this threat alive, and we'll just fix them all. We don't have enough time. And we can't even fix probably one or two of them.
You're right. Hey,
so that is the situation. That's the context in which I'm doing what I'm doing.
How can people find you? Because our time just went by so fast. How can people find your organization?
Well, ParadigmResearchGroup.org. Paradigm, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, researchgroup.org. You can Google Stephen Bassett with a P-H. And everything is there, contact information, emails, subscribe to the email list, phone number, all that stuff. It's all there. I'm based in Washington and Hollywood, California now. There's some big announcements coming from PRG very soon. But I know we didn't have a lot of time, so I wanted to get that fundamental message across. Just boil it all down to this. Why are the ETs here? Why are they turning off our nuclear weapons? What is the concern, and where are we with respect to nuclear war? What happens if we get disclosure? What happens if we get open contact? And then here's the final punchline. I believe when open contact takes place, the ETs are literally going to give us a very simple offer. If you want to come out into space, if you want to build interstellar craft, you have to get rid of your nukes, all of your nukes, because we're never going to let you put nukes on an interstellar craft and come out in the galaxy where you could surprise us. That's never, ever going to happen. And you need to get rid of them because you're going to destroy yourselves. And we will then have this momentous decision to make in the post-disclosure world with our countries already in contact with multiple civilizations that are working in alliance, basically saying it's time to get rid of the nukes, guys, and then you can come out and hang with us, and perhaps some technology could be provided, and a whole complete shift in the course of human history, which for the last 10,000 years has been headed for this one event, which is nuclear war. We've spent 10,000 years destroying each other, killing each other, wiping out civilizations, building bigger and bigger weapons until we built weapons enough to destroy our own civilization. And so now we have to make a decision. Are we going to destroy ourselves or are we going to take action? Obviously, we have not taken action on our own. The ETs have intervened. I'm trying to describe how that intervention is going to unfold. Disclosure, open contact, here's the deal, make your decision. And if the decision is you're not going to get rid of the nukes, can't get rid of those, love the nukes, got to have the nukes, the answer will be fine. No interstellar ship will ever leave your planet, all right? Trust me, it'll never happen. And if you have your nuclear war, we will leave. We'll come back in, I don't know, 500, 1,000, 2,000 years and see how you're doing. And maybe we could revisit this. This sounds profoundly, maybe almost silly. It isn't. In fact, it is an absolute logical extension of what we have seen happen. I want to go back before 47. From 47 to this day, and 2021, this is the best explanation I have been able to come up with to describe, at least in the fundamental sense, what the hell has been happening in those 75 years without getting into all the granular stuff. It is an engagement. It is geopolitical or solar political or galactic political. And it has to do with the nukes. And it has to do with saving ourselves from them with their assistance. Well, that's something, Stephen, your listeners can think about.
Okay, my friend. Well, thank you so much for coming on. We got to run for a commercial break.
And adios.
Okay, we'll talk to you here in the near future.
Over plenty of time.
Okay, my friend. You take care.
And deeds betray. There are myths that persist, and we all know words can keep the truth at bay. You know that open could leave you wide open. Fear closes in, and heroes don't always win. When you are ready to hold the line, defended on all sides, till little by little the middle was hard to find. Forget about the life you thought you'd be living. Forget about the world you left behind. When you thought you could fly, now you're trapped inside
the chrysalis.
Bring on the night with Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
You want to answer that, don't you? I bet it's just killing you seeing the soft glow just inches away. Someone wants to tell you something or ask you something. Oh, come on, answer it already! Just so we're clear, that wasn't my fault. Next time, ignore your inner voice. Don't text and drive.
A message from Florida's trusted choice, independent insurance agents.
You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio, After Dark, with our host, Gary Anderson.
And that is me. Well, James, who's our next guest?
Oh, boy, our next guest is a Mr. Stephen Starr. Now, he is a clinical laboratory science program director and assistant clinical professor associate at Missouri University. He is also an authority from A to Z on everything nuclear related.
Interesting. Well, welcome to the show, Stephen. How are you doing tonight?
I'm fine, thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Well, can you tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm trained as a scientist. I've worked in medical laboratories for like 30 years, but I actually started in nuclear engineering when I entered college, and I got interested in nuclear weapons in third grade when we were doing duck and cover drills. But I wound up writing a paper that was published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in 2004, and I got invited to a conference in Washington, D.C., and I met a retired Soviet colonel who I wound up working with, and it just started, one thing led to another, and I've been writing about nuclear weapons for quite some time now. I've got a website, nuclearfamine.org, where if your listeners find what we talk about interesting, they can go there and get more detailed information.
You know, I remember that too. I'm going on 70, and I remember we had to go, like in grade school, we had to go underneath the table. You know, the alarm would go off and the teacher would say, okay, everybody under the table, and you have so much time to do it. Like it would have done any good. You know, I remember, not many people remember this, but Ronald Reagan, when he was our president, actually did a short film, What to Do, you know, how to protect yourself in case of a nuclear war. And the one that stands out, and I don't know if you ever seen it or heard about it, was the one where he told people, go out in your yard and dig a hole at least 6 feet deep. And
I remember that. I think there was something entitled like With Enough Shovels or something like that. But yeah, there's the government's been pretty good at giving false reassurances about nuclear war for a long time. I don't think they talk about it much anymore. It actually was a topic of presidential debates and that for quite some time. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, 1991, I think it was, it just kind of vanished. I was among the people that thought nuclear war wasn't going to be a problem anymore. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, it's actually, I am more nervous about nuclear war now than ever. You know, I remember being young. And our local newspaper in Seattle was the PI and the Seattle Times. And every day you'd open up, and it was either on the first page or the second or third page, you know, all these scenarios, you know, of all the tension between the Times, Soviet Union, and the United States, you know, all this gloom. And, you know, again, you know, when you're younger and you see stuff like that, it really affects you. And then, you know, like you said, when the wall came down and everything, people, you know, kind of forgot about it. But what really concerns me, and, you know, is what's going on now in the, you know, Taiwan and China and what we've been doing with Russia, you know, at the Black Sea. It seems like we're escalating, and we got, I think, a Cold War now worse than what we ever had. Now, I could be totally wrong.
No, I'd agree with you. I think if you look at the doomsday clock that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has, it's closer to midnight than it ever has been before. It's just that, what worries me is it goes back to the fact that people are so uninformed about nuclear weapons. I teach a class at the University of Missouri, and I have students come in. They're very smart students, but they've basically been taught nothing about nuclear weapons. And I think that if you do that for enough generations, you know, it's not only the students, but it's the political leaders. And, you know, I have to hope that the military knows enough about how the weapons work that we can not get into a nuclear war. But I think, you know, things happen so fast when you have launch-ready nuclear weapons. Both the U.S. and Russian presidents are followed around 24/7 by an officer that carries what they call the nuclear briefcase. And that allows either president to give the permission order to launch a nuclear attack in less than a minute. It's not exactly a democratic process when you start a nuclear war. They don't go to Congress and and take a vote. So even though they talk about deterrence, you know, it seems to have prevented nuclear war, but all it takes is a single failure of deterrence for a nuclear war to start. And they have to make it very easy to start because they want to be able to launch the weapons as fast as they can. And so the U.S. and Russia each have something like between 800 and 1,000 nuclear warheads that are between 5 and 50 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, and they have those ready to launch in 2 to 15 minutes. So
that is scary. You know, and I'm not political. Right? I try to not be political. It's hard not to be. But, you know, when Trump was president, towards the end of his, you know, being president, we had a high-ranking general call up China, you know, his counterpart, and saying, hey, you know, we're kind of worried that maybe something could happen, and gave him the heads up. I mean, when you look at when one person has that much authority, that is kind of scary because, you know, things can escalate. I mean, again, look what's going on at the strait, you know, where Taiwan is, and the Strait of Japan, where, you know, now, you know, we're flexing, we're running our ships through it. Now the Chinese just yesterday went through an area which, you know, Chinese claim it's theirs. You know, we've had the Chinese up in Alaska. You know, it's just a lot of things. The tensions are just building up, and people don't realize all it takes is one little mistake. And
right. I think when you have two countries that are both armed with nuclear weapons, they get into a direct military conflict. Well, then there's going to be a question about either somebody has to back down at some place or else they continue to escalate. And the problem with escalation is it can happen so quickly because you start fighting and sinking ships and planes are shot down and maybe bases are bombed. And then what happens? You know, how do you, you're worried that the other side might launch a weapon before you do. And so it can happen very quickly. I mean, jet planes fly so fast, it's very easy to overfly. Somebody can make a mistake. There's so many ways a nuclear war can start that it really has been kind of a miracle that we haven't had one. But I could go into a lot of details about there's other people that are pre-delegated to launch a nuclear war in case, say, the president gets taken out. And we don't really even know how far down the chain of command that goes, but different generals, and that can become complicated in a warfighting situation.
Oh, it could. Now, I want to backtrack when I mentioned about that little film that Reagan did about digging a hole 6 feet down and taking a door off your house and putting 3 feet of dirt on it. My determination is, well, it's a good way to bury somebody. I don't think that would protect you if you got hit anywhere near a strike, would it?
No, not at all. And, you know, my website basically focuses on the long-term environmental consequences of nuclear war, which very few people are aware of. You know, we instantly think about blast and fire and radioactive fallout from a nuclear weapon. But, you know, what the scientists found over a decade ago was that the smoke from burning cities would actually create a global stratospheric smoke layer, would block enough sunlight to even prevent, you know, crops from being grown for up to 10 years with a large nuclear war. And so you don't, even if you forget about all the other horrible things nuclear weapons do, you wind up having most people starving to death. There's an article that on the website I have. It's called Self-Assured Destruction that some of these scientists wrote. And basically they say that even a successful first strike, if the U.S. took out all the Russian weapons with the first strike, nuclear strike, the smoke from that strike would wind up causing a nuclear famine that would wind up killing most people on the planet from starvation. So that's, and nobody knows about that. I mean, that's one of the things that bothers me is that, you know, we can't get the political and military leaders to publicly acknowledge and discuss these, their peer-reviewed studies about the scientific, you know, scientifically predicted consequences of nuclear war.
You know, it's scary. You know, people are worried about global warming, which is, you know, something we know is going on. But again, if we had a nuclear attack or we did the first strike or whatever, what you're saying, basically, we're going to go into nuclear winter. The crops are going to not grow. We're going to be in, aren't we going to be pretty much like nighttime, like when Mount St. Helens went? We had a period of time.
You're right. there's a on the website, there's a section called Catastrophic Environmental Consequences of Nuclear War. It details what, you know, they predict about 180 million tons of soot and smoke would rise above cloud level into the stratosphere. That would block about 70% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere from reaching the surface of the Earth. And so at noon, the sun would look like a full moon, basically. It'd be that dark. And because the smoke's up in the stratosphere, it can't be rained out. The sun actually heats the smoke and causes a self-lofting effect. It's like heating a balloon or black solar collector. It gets so hot up there that it actually gets up to about the boiling point of water, and then that actually leads to the destruction of the protective ozone layer too. So there's all sorts of bad things that can go on. But there's another thing that people don't know about an India-Pakistan nuclear war. They did studies on that. And 100 atomic bombs, the total of those detonated in the large cities of India and Pakistan, would put about 5 million tons of smoke in the stratosphere, and that would block 10% of the sunlight, and it would create the coldest average surface temperatures in the last 1,000 years. You'd probably have killing frosts every month of the year in, like, New England or someplace. So any nuclear war is going to have dramatically, really catastrophic effects on the global environment.
Well, how about radiation, too? I mean, I was here when Mount St. Helens went. And I tell you, in Seattle, I mean, it looked like it was snowing. And if you have enough nukes going off, the radiation, wouldn't that spread? And that would...
I mean, there's just an unlimited number of horrific effects. If they target nuclear power plants, each commercial reactor's got what they call a spent fuel pool on site where they haven't developed a long-term geologic storage in the U.S. They did, but they didn't open it. So there's something like 5 to 7 sets of fuel rods next to the reactor outside of the core. If they hit that, I mean, those would greatly increase the radioactive fallout. You know, there's something like 200 to 300 cities of populations of over 100,000 in the U.S. and and Russia. And if, you know, when you're thinking about something like 1,600 nuclear weapons on each side ready to go off in a matter of 15 minutes, you have plenty of weapons for the cities. They're not going to skip a lot of targets. It's really a kind of a grim topic, but I think that people need to at least have some comprehension that these weapons exist and that they're ready to use at any given moment. Some people find comfort in that, but I think that we'd be better off in the long run to try to, you know, normalize relations and get rid of these arsenals to the point where, you know, you might be able to, even if you knock them down to, say, 100 weapons per nation state, at least you wouldn't necessarily be able to kill everybody on the planet with a war. So we've got a long way to go for that, though. There's about 13,000 to 14,000 nuclear weapons right now in the global arsenal.
Well, you know, again, too, I've heard scenarios, if it was a major nuclear war, it could cause more than just a nuclear winter. It could actually even take our planet and take it off its axis, too. I've read that.
I don't have any information on that. But, I like all the other creatures that are living on the planet, too. And it bothers me that it's not just humans that are going to get wiped out. Most of the land animals would be very much subject to some massive nuclear war like that, because if crops can't grow for 10 years, like right now, the global grain reserves, we've got enough grain stored for like maybe a couple of months, 3 months. So you go try not having being able to grow any crops for, 5 to 10 years. They predict after a large nuclear war, every day it would be below freezing in central North America and Eurasia for up to 3 years.
Yeah, and you know what? We don't have the petroleum. We would not have the food. I mean, just look what's going on now in the grocery stores. There's a shortage of food again, and along with toilet paper. Could you imagine, if we survived a nuclear war? I mean, not just that. Even if it was a minor nuclear war, I mean, growing crops are going to be maybe radioactive, so you can't eat it. All the same with the what survives in cattle and animals and stuff. And again, if it gets into the ocean, which undoubtedly it's going to do, because, you know, I can't remember that one movie, but, you know, it was made in the 50s where there was a nuclear war and the radiation went all around the earth. The last surviving country was in Australia. And,
right.
And it really...
On the Beach, I believe that was the name of it.
And it made logical sense to me, even when I was young and I watched that for the first time. It scared me.
Yeah, I remember that too. I gave a talk in Melbourne where they filmed some of that, and that was probably 10 years ago. But, you know, you don't even have to have a nuclear war. I've been writing a paper that's, I haven't got it on the website yet, but it's about the effect of a high-altitude nuclear detonation that causes what they call electromagnetic pulse. And it creates this massive electrical fields over vast areas, and it has the capacity, just one weapon has the capacity to take out the U.S. National Electric Grid. And one weapon could also take out two or three dozen nuclear power plants at the same time, too, because the E1 component it's almost instantaneous, happens in a billionth of a second, and it induces high voltages and currents into power lines and transmission lines to go in, and anything that's connected to that gets the microchips or the integrated circuits get fried. And those are in everything. They're in all the critical national infrastructure. I've worried particularly about nuclear power plants because it would basically knock out their emergency cooling system and backup power. The plant would be able to shut down, but it wouldn't be able to cool off. You have to you have to instantly turn almost the emergency cooling system to keep a nuclear power plant from melting down. So that's another aspect of nuclear weapons that's really not discussed very often.
Well, their backup systems, like their generators, okay, they only have a certain amount of diesel hand. So if there was a major, you know, where they lost the power, you know, within a week or 14 days, you know, without diesel to run the generators, we're going to have meltdowns. And, you know, even here in Washington State, I'm not that far away from a couple of reactors, and that always seems to bother me every time I have ever drove by it.
Well, the U.S. Air Academy, it's the Air Force Academy, published a paper on this, two papers in 2018 and 2019, and the first one did focus specifically on what you were saying about if the grid goes down. See, the E3 component of hemp, the electromagnetic pulse will basically destroy most of the large power transformers in the United States, and those are what are essential for the long-distance transmission of electric power. There's not a lot of them. You know, there's like a couple thousand, basically, and we don't make any of the really big ones in the United States. It takes about 2 years to order one from overseas and get it shipped here, and they weigh up to 800,000 pounds, so they're pretty big to move around. So if those basically all got damaged or fried with one hemp explosion, the grid would be down for months or maybe, you know, as long as a year or two. And so that's you can protect that. The reason I'm writing this paper is because there are actually technological fixes. You can
Hell
protect
yeah.
the transformers. So.
Yeah, that's what astounds me. And, you know, I read a report that leaked out from the CIA. They said the grid system, you know, the majority, I mean, there might be some little pockets, okay, but the majority of the grid system would be down for over 2 years, and the death rate from that, it would be major. And that is scary, and you're right. You know, India and Pakistan make our transformers. Because I talked to our local power company here, and they said, you know, yeah, they have a couple transformers. Like if the ones in the power on the telephone poles go, they can replace a certain amount of them. But they don't even have a big stock of that because, again, there's a back order on them. You know, we're not the only country buying them. We don't make them here anymore because the oils in it causes cancer. So they're handmade and made in, you know, Pakistan. They're made in India in third world countries where they are very lax on those type of laws. And so if our grid system goes down, you know, we're in a major problem. And what really upsets me is, you know, we talked about the wall. We talk about this. We talk about what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now with this great new bill they're trying to pass. But there's not 1 cent, not 1 cent to shore up our grid system.
Right.
And you know, that is scary.
They tried to pass bills in 2013 and 2015, but they were blocked. It's the electric utility companies that block the bills for the transformers. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is the one that blocks the things that can be done to protect the nuclear power plants, or at least minimize some of the effects of the EMP. And it's going to cost too much, but they predicted the cost was about $2 billion, and if it was done on a non-emergency basis, it would take 3 to 5 years. We should have had that done by now. I mean, $2 billion. How many trillions? Trillions, a thousand billion, right? Haven't they just created something like $4,000 billion out of thin air in the last year or so? We're not spending the money on the stuff that we need.
You're right. And let's get really honest here. You know, they're talking about going digital money. Let's face it. There's no gold on the earth to back up what our country, the UK, Germany, or any other country, their debts. I mean, right. It's all made up numbers. So what difference does it make? It's just
at the risk of sounding a little political, I don't like the idea of a digital currency, because then if you don't have cash anymore, you can't take your money out of the bank and it can be instantly confiscated. And China does that sort of thing. You can limit the area where you can spend a digital currency. But I see that as antithetical to democracy.
Now, here's what I think. Seriously, and I've talked about it before. People need to stockpile at least 3-4 months worth of food. You know, maybe it's the rice. Maybe it's stuff they don't really want to eat. And stockpile, if they have the availability of a couple hundred gallons of water. I got a couple hundred gallon drums at my place, just in case something happens. I got water to survive, because you know what? You're not going to turn your water on, because if the power isn't working, you're not going to get water. And you're not going to go to the store, and you're not going to go on the internet. You're not going to go to the cash machine and put your card in there and pull money out of your bank account. You're not going to go into your bank and say, hey, I want to withdraw $100. That's not going to happen, because the monetary system will collapse.
Well, I've been writing about nuclear weapons for a long time, but the one nice, I don't know if it's a nice thing, but the good thing, it's an incentive for me to write about EMP, is that there are technological fixes. You can protect the large power transformers, and you can add lots of different types of shielding at nuclear power plants. You can also take the fuel out of the spent fuel pools and put it into dry cast storage, so if there's a pool fire, it won't, you know, contaminate an area the size of a state. You can spend money to reduce the dangers of these things. It's just that all this is being blocked by the utility companies, basically.
Yeah, and you know, we spend more money, when you really think about it, military-wise, each year than it would take to fix the grid system.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, that's what makes me pull my hair out. Because one of these days, I'm going to be honest with you, one of these days, some country out there, some third world, or not even, I don't even know what we are anymore, is going to, you know, something's going to happen. And again, you know, China is threatening us a couple of times, like, hey, we don't have to destroy your city or your cities. We can just, well, fire a nuke over you and take out your whole grid system.
Right. Well, North Korea has, they've launched two what they call communication satellites. And one of them routinely goes over the United States every couple of days. And it's just at the right altitude for an EMP detonation. They've never observed that satellite to give off any electronic signals. So what if it's a nuclear weapon? You know, there's a lot of possibilities out there that I've worked with he's actually a major in the Air Force. He helped write some of the reports that I mentioned for the U.S. Air Academy. And he wrote a paper about even a weather balloon or a Scud missile launched off the coast would be capable of, you know, you don't have to be very precise with an EMP weapon. You just have to get it kind of in the general vicinity and at the right altitude. And so it's not, it's this, this whole subject though has been kind of branded as a neocon issue, and it's dismissed that way. It's like, well, you know, this is not, it's not realistic. If there was ever one nuclear bomb that go off, it'd be a nuclear war, then we have other problems. But how, you know, there's such a thing as called asymmetrical warfare. You know, maybe you don't have to have, all it takes is one bomb basically to totally disable the United States. So I think it's a good idea to invest some money into protecting the grid and the power transformers and the reactors.
Yeah, and if not just the grid, if they detonated something over our country, you're not going to go into your car, and you're going to put the key in, because unless you got an old Edsel or something, okay, or a Model T, or you know, a 57 Chevy, you're going to put it in any modern car or truck, right, or semi-truck. You're going to put your key in there, and guess what? It's not going to start. Because the electronics, these new vehicles in the last 15, 20 years, and now even more than ever, is all dependent on computers. And the reason why I say this, because my wife, Mitsubishi, had a computer go out, and it was doing a lot of weird things. Could you imagine if we got hit? That's it. You're not going to go to the grocery store. And it wouldn't matter anyway, because the grocery stores won't have anything. We need to take a break, Stephen. This was about 3 minutes long. When you come back, can we talk step by step? Let's pretend we got hit. Or sure. We hit another country with a nuclear war. And let's go through the steps. Let's take right. The people and shock them and let them realize what could actually happen. How's that sound?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that.
Okay, we'll be back with Stephen Starr right after this. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
You can advertise your business on Night Dreams Talk Radio, and you will be heard worldwide. Why not contact us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com?
You and I, living in the strangest of times, on my hill, watching while the cities rise, from the collapse that we left, when the sun beat it down to the valley. Seems that I knew you before, but when
Bring on the night with Night Dreams Talk Radio with Gary Anderson.
Do you have a paranormal story you want to share on Night Dreams Talk Radio? You could be a guest. Email us at nightdreamstalkradio@gmail.com.
You are listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio Network, from our compound to you worldwide, with your host, Gary Anderson.
And that is me. Well, here it is, the 21st of October, about a week away or so, to give or take a day or two, to Halloween. And we're going to have, all next week, we're going to have storytellers on. We're going to have people, you know, talking scary things, you know, like truckers driving late at night and seeing, well, a young lady or a young guy walking late on the side of the road. They give them a ride, and they're talking for a while. Next thing, they turn over to ask them a question, and they have vanished. We're going to have a great show next week. And don't forget, this Friday, tomorrow, you can win a Night Dreams Talk Radio t-shirt, a real nice one. Check out our website. Look at our store. Help support the show. And now we're back with our guest, Stephen Starr, and we're going to talk about what we would be looking forward to if there was a nuclear war, and step by step. We're back, Stephen.
Hi. I was thinking about what I should talk about. I thought first I should just explain a little bit about what a nuclear weapon is compared to a conventional explosive. The largest bomb that was detonated in World War II was about 10 tons of TNT explosive equivalent. The largest weapons we have now, conventional, the Moab weapons, are something like 20,000 pounds of explosive, maybe. And so the Hiroshima bomb that was dropped on Japan had 15,000 tons of TNT explosive. So they're literally about 1,000 times bigger than the largest conventional explosive. But a nuclear weapon is more than just explosive power. It's almost like a piece of the sun when it goes off. And the fireball that it creates, actually the surface of the fireball can be hotter than the surface of the sun. The size of the fireball will depend on the explosive power of the weapon. But I wrote an article about the effects of an 800 kiloton Russian nuclear warhead detonated above New York City. It's on the website I have, nuclearfamine.org. And Russia has about 450 of those they can launch within a few minutes. So wow. This is the effect of one of those weapons. If it 1 second after the detonation of a weapon like that, the fireball would be about a mile in diameter, and it would be about 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the surface of the sun. And in 30 or 40 seconds later, it would start to rise and pull in air towards the perimeter, like 300 to 400 mile an hour winds. But that fireball would ignite anything flammable out for a distance of about 7 miles in all directions. And so basically, and that's a different kind of fire. We've had seen fires like that in World War II when they firebombed Dresden and Hamburg. All those fires are set simultaneously. We're used to line fires that kind of burn in a line when the wind pushes them. But this is, when you set fires over a huge area like that, it will all coalesce into a single mass fire in most environments. And then that has like an effect of a giant chimney. It sucks in the air towards the center, has hurricane force winds, and in about 20 or 30 minutes, the air temperatures rise above the boiling point of water. So you have an area of somewhere between 900 and 150 square miles where the firestorm takes place, and basically nothing's going to survive in that area. So I mean, that as far as war planners like to think about the blast effects, they'll plan multiple explosions in an area like that to make sure they knock down the buildings. But if you're a civilian, it really doesn't matter. You're going to die just from the fire if you're there. Even if you're in a shelter, it'll get so hot it'll pull the oxygen out of there and, you know, bake you in there.
Now you're talking a shelter. You talking about like these people who have underground shelters, fallout shelters?
Yeah, anybody that's in a fire zone like that, even if you're in a deep basement of a building or whatever, it's not going to do you any good because, you know, when they had the firebombing in Dresden and Hamburg, they couldn't even drive tracked vehicles in there for a number of days. They would open up the shelters where people had been, the bodies would burst into flames. I mean, it's just incredibly hot. You're talking about you know, well over 1,000 degrees in that area. It burns everything. Anything that's remotely combustible will burn. And so when you think about it, you know, a fire that's 150 square miles, you know, surface area, that's one weapon. So then if you think about a war that's fought with hundreds or thousands of these weapons, then you wind up having fire set over areas of tens or hundreds of thousands of square miles within a period of an hour, because that's how long it takes for, you know, the missiles only take 30 minutes or so to go, ICBM, to go from one continent to another. If you have a submarine parked off the coast, it can take, you know, as little as, you know, 7 minutes to hit a target. And now with the hypersonic weapons, they're even going faster. So
that's scary. These,
yeah, it's really insane. I mean, the Mach, they have, the Russians have an avant-garde warhead that goes 20 times the speed of sound. And we don't have any defense against that. And I, you know, hope they think about that in Washington.
Well, you know, I just, like, you know, I mentioned when I had Steve Bassett on, you know, China this last week, and it really got the military and the Pentagon freaked out. They sent a missile, you know, it didn't have the nuclear device on it, but had a conventional on it. It circled the Earth, and then it hit its target.
That's right. You know, people aren't educated here. It's not in the news. I don't really feel like we get a lot of good news most of the time. We get kind of headline news. But the Russians have come out with a whole variety of new weapon systems. They're very far ahead of the U.S. in terms of their hypersonic weapons. We're still testing prototypes, and they've got deployed weapons. Their Zircon anti-ship missiles. They're sharing their technology with China. Russia's been actually helping China build an early warning system. Russia's got a naval base over there on Sakhalin Island. That's you know, over in that China Sea area. They just did a big naval exercise with China. We don't hear about any of that stuff, but you know, I don't see any point in going over and trying to start a war 5,000 miles away from the U.S. on this freedom of navigation stuff when, you know, we have a few problems here at home that might need some attention.
Well, we have a lot, like the virus still going on, maybe the economy, and a whole bunch of other things. But what really scares me is, you know, I can see the point of freedom of navigation. I can see that. But we've been pushing it. And now you have China ended up on our doorstep off of Alaska. And then you have the Russians, you know, off Alaska, you know, kind of like right there, just to show us, because, if we do it, we're going to do it also. And then we get all freaked out. And every time something happens like that, right, I don't know what safeguards China has compared to what the safeguards Russia has. And it concerns me, what happens if somebody decides to fire a missile towards a aircraft carrier or one of our destroyers, or they decide to ram one of them? Is it going to escalate? And could it escalate really fast?
Well, if you look at the way hypersonic weapons work, you know, it's our carrier battle groups are basically obsolete in the face of these weapons. We can't really fight a peer like that because we can't defend against them. We don't have any anti-missile systems that can shoot down a swarm of hypersonic missiles that come after a carrier group. So if they really think they're going to get in a fight with China or Russia, they're going to have to park their carrier groups far enough out of range. But, you know, the ranges are really almost the whole entire Mediterranean can be covered by Russian fighters with Zircon missiles. I just, you know... It's not a good idea to start a war with either China or Russia. I don't believe they want one. But, you know, we've got ourselves in a bad situation in a lot of ways. I think we made a big mistake basically allowing most of our industrial base to get moved over to China. You know, it's like 60% of the goods that come back to the U.S. are from, you know, American corporations that move their factories to China. So how are we going to win a trade war with them? They could nationalize all the factories if they wanted to.
Well, that, you know, and I said it last week because I know people in the mortgage company, you know, companies that work for high up, actually, in one mortgage company. And I asked them, I said, you know, who owns my mortgage? Well, we don't know. Okay, come on, be honest with me. Who owns our mortgage? The average person's mortgage in this country. And they said, well, the magic C word that China has been buying in great big bundles. Some of these banks, you know, they give you a mortgage on your house. You make your payments to the mortgage company, right? Or your servicer. But they don't own it. They've sold it out to whatever, a corporation in China. Mm. And that is really scary because a lot of people think, oh, gee, I have, you know, such and such bank, a mortgage with them. They don't. And that really scares me that we allowed ourselves to, you know, we don't make anything in this country virtually anymore. It's all made in China. You know, I ride a Harley Davidson motorcycle, right? It's assembled in the United States, and a few parts are made in the United States. But if you start looking at all the parts on it, it says China on it.
Yes. Well, the same thing for the large power transformers we were talking about. We don't make much of anything here anymore, except we make a lot of weapons and we have aircraft and that sort of thing. But we really have fallen behind. We've had so much money that's gone into corrupted expenditures in the Pentagon, like the F-35. You know, that plane's kind of a joke compared to some of the Russian jets that are fifth generation fighters. And I think it's sad. You know, like I hate to see the country in this kind of shape, but the reason I really certainly don't want to see a nuclear war either. And I think that it's important that it's hard for people. What do people do about nuclear weapons? You know, but at the very least, they need to be informed about the existence of these arsenals and to understand then how dangerous it is to pursue these, you know, direct military conflicts. And, you know, whether it's in Ukraine or the South China Sea, we just do not need to start fights in any of those areas.
That's the whole point, because nobody is going to win and at the end. And, you know, again, too, it started a couple years ago in North Dakota, South Dakota, but mainly in North Dakota and even in Montana. There is areas where the wealthy people are building big, huge bunkers underground. There's this one area. There's one bunker after another where, you know, set up for wealthy people. Just in case something happens, they can bug out. But again, what are they going to bug out to? Because after the missiles hit and all that stuff, what do they have to look forward to?
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, it is doom and gloom when you talk about a nuclear war. I almost feel guilty when I teach my classes. I have a class I teach on nuclear weapons at the University of Missouri, and you know, most of the students have no idea. They don't know the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. They don't know there's, you know, 14,000 nuclear weapons ready to go. They don't know any of that. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, they're pretty much, they're all horrified.
Well, can you explain to the listeners there, what's the difference between the nuclear devices?
Okay, well, the atomic bomb, that's like a first generation nuclear weapon. And the bombs we dropped on Japan, those were atomic bombs, and their explosive power is about something like 15 or 20,000 tons of TNT. But then in the 1950s, we developed what they called hydrogen bombs. Those are thermonuclear weapons. They work on a different principle of fusion combined with fission, but their explosive power then went up another 1,000 times. You know, instead of 15 kilotons, they had 1,000 kiloton weapons. They had weapons that basically vaporized entire islands that they tested out in the Pacific.
Yeah. You know,
they measured the explosive power on those in megatons, which are millions of tons of TNT. And if you think of a ton is 2,000 pounds, so you're talking billions and billions of pounds of TNT all in one bomb. The numbers sort of become meaningless at some point. I mean, I've got some videos on my website of the nuclear tests, and the big one that they had, the Bravo test, they took pictures of it from 50 miles away. You know, when you look at this enormous fireball rising up, I mean, it's just incredible. It's unearthly, really. But that's where it should be. It shouldn't be on the Earth. It's like the sun in the atmosphere, but we, you know, it's the sun's better off 92 million miles away than like 1,500 feet above your city.
So, again, all these people going and building fallout shelters and stuff. I know somebody here just down the road from us, they put in a fallout shelter. And I'm thinking, you know, we're about 12 miles away from Bangor. That's a major, you know, sub-base. They have nuclear weapons there. Yeah. And then the joint, Fort Lewis and McCord, is about another 15 miles the other opposite way. And, you know, if either one of them, you know, if a war ever broke out, Bangor is going to be the number one to go. And then, you know, the other is going to go. And everything in between is going to, isn't it? Everything between is going to be gone, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you'd almost be better off to drive over there and wait for the weapon to land than try to hide out from it. Just get it over with. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at the fallout patterns from some of the nuclear tests, for example, just the radioactivity would go many hundreds of miles and it would contaminate islands downwind. They had some of the islands in the Bikini Islands that the people there could never even go back to their original atoll where they were evacuated from. So there's just so many things that are devastating about these weapons that, yeah, it's sort of a, you're kind of kidding yourself if you think you're going to hide in a shelter and be okay in 3 weeks.
Well, unless you're a politician and you can go into a secured shelter where they figured, you know, people can survive for a couple of years, like a major city. I've seen some of those, and I tell you, that is really alarming, too. Because for the average citizen has no place to go. I mean, it's pretty much, I hate to say it, you go underneath your kitchen table. That's going to be, you know, about the only protection you have. I don't want to think about that.
The deplorables are the expendables.
Yeah. So fireball would come, then we'd have the radiation, and, you know, like, in Japan, when we dropped those two nuclear bombs, there was some survivors. But what they went through, you know, that was horrible, too.
Well, if you want to get into the details, when you detonate a bomb and the fireball doesn't touch the ground, you'll have radioactive fallout, but it's not nearly as bad as if the fireball actually touches the surface of the Earth, it vaporizes like millions of tons. It can. And all those particles will become highly radioactive because of neutron activation. So you'll have much greater fallout if they're aiming a weapon where they're trying to do ground bursts to take out, for example, the naval base you're talking about. You're going to have massive fallout from something like that. You still will have a lot of radioactive fallout when they're air bursts that are designed for thermal effects. But it's not in the same order of magnitude as you would from ground bursts.
How about, though, you know, I've been reading about they have developed nuclear bombs that basically will leave the cities intact, that the radiation would not be there so long, where they could then, if they wanted to invade or whatever, they would be able to go in to those cities and take control. But it basically would kill the population. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, you're talking about, they call them neutron bombs. They make the bomb give off a specialized type of radiation and minimize the blasts and thermal effects. It's also a battlefield weapon, so you can kill people in tanks and that sort of thing. And I don't know, you know, that it sort of had bad publicity, but I'm sure they probably have some of them stashed somewhere. In a way, the EMP weapons, there are supposed to be super EMP weapons. I believe that the U.S. and Russia and China have made those, and I don't know if North Korea has or not, but the way that works is they can direct the gamma rays down towards the surface, and it's the gamma rays are what cause, they rip the electrons off the air molecules, and they send them spinning towards the Earth to create this enormous burst of electromagnetic energy that, you know, fries all the integrated circuits. So, yeah, there's all kinds of variations you can get with nuclear weapons. It's an engineering problem, but I think we'd be better off working on other engineering issues that, like with sanitation and that sort of thing.
I know, and you know, without a Faraday cage, right? Even if you did, if you had your computer or your TV, for example, unplugged, isn't it going to still take it out unless it has some type of grounding system to it?
Yeah, it probably would. It depends sort of where the proximity is. But there's with EMP, there's E1, E2, and E3. The E1 happens instantaneously. E2 is kind of like lightning, and the E3 is delayed, and it's a, but the E1 component will fry all the circuits. I mean, it's particularly anything that operates on a low voltage, whether it's like a laptop computer, anything like a modem. I mean, you name it, and telecommunication devices, sanitation, transportation, communication. They're everywhere. So it would fry all of that stuff.
And that's scary when you think about it. I mean, as even, you know, anything like that, again, that's, your car is not going to start. I was also reading, even if we got hit by a major flare, which we've been getting a lot of flares lately hitting the earth, the internet, they said that most of the internet in our country would survive, but going to Europe or going out of the country, the internet would not survive, because pretty much now everything is fiber optic in our country with the internet, pretty much. But
go ahead, I'm sorry.
But going to, let's say, the UK or going to Europe, they still have these cables with copper wire in it that every 15 or 30 miles they got a booster to boost up the signal. And that a flare or a nuke device would take out the internet.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the solar flare. They can call that a geomagnetic disturbance, or the scientific name is a coronal mass ejection. But it's a solar flare in a sense that it's a massive charged particles that hit the Earth. And that happens. They had one in 1859. It's called, a guy named Carrington saw it, an astronomer. So. But back then, of course, they didn't have any electronics, but it set all the telegraph wires on fire. And if we have anything that's close to that, it'll do the same thing as the E3 and hemp. It basically, they're very similar. They induce current, and they can do it into buried lines as well as above ground. So that's one of the things that's different than the E1. They did have an E3 test in the Soviet Union right before they stopped the atmospheric testing, and they induced a current into a buried cable that went about, I don't know, several hundred miles and caught a power station on fire. So, these things are not, it's just another thing that's sort of regarded as a curiosity, but I think it's something that really, like I said, I've been writing about it because you can actually protect at least the large power transformers, and not only from the E3, but from the coronal mass ejection, too, like you're talking about, the solar flare. So
yeah, we need to really start worrying about other things in politics and what's going on. How can people find your website? Our time is up. It went by so fast, and I had so many more questions to ask you. How can they find you for more information?
Well, look at nuclearfamine.org, or just search for nuclear famine. And I do have a contact part up there where you can email me if you like, and there's all sorts of information on that site. If you're curious about anything we talked about, there's a lot more detail there, and I'd be glad to talk to you again sometime too, if that would help.
Okay, that would help. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show. You have a great weekend. It's coming up. Okay,
thank you. You too.
Okay, you take care, my friend. Well, James, who's our guest tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow our guest is going to be Mr. Kevin Trenberth, and he's from New Zealand, but he's going to be talking about climate change and everything involved with it.
That is going to be really, really interesting because, you know, again, people are in denial about climate changes. We've had various scientists on the show say, it's not happening, but it is happening. And, again, like Captain Paul Watson, I'm sorry I keep mentioning his name, but if you get into Antarctica and you get into the South and North Pole, it's some areas it's getting colder than ever recorded. But then other areas it's thawing out. And as it was explained to us, that's what happens when you have climate changes. It goes erratic. So different areas get different results. I mean, at this point, they're saying 20 by 2035, as I mentioned the other day, parts of, well, West Coast and the East Coast, you know, unless you got really tall stilts, you're not going to go out in your yard. let alone be able to even go in your front room because it's going to be underwater. So we got a lot of that, you know, we're going to talk about tomorrow. And don't forget, again, next week, we got a lot of guests on, don't we?
Oh, we do. And boy, we've got a whole lineup of guests coming on telling about scary stories.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be the scary story week here at Night Dreams Talk Radio. Again, everybody, you know, if you want to check out our website, you want to get a Night Dreams t-shirt, mug, Bigfoot mug, really cool, just go to our website. It helps support the show at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. You can, you know, get everything from a hoodie to a tee to a tumbler to a mug and more on our website, all greatly designed compared to what we had in the past. I want to thank Ricky, one of our staff members, for that. Really some cool stuff. And I'll be updating the web again this weekend for all our guests for next week. And I tell your friends about us. You know, YouTube is still fairly new to us. I mean, we have a large listener base on radio and on the internet. But, you know, I look at YouTube and I see 510 people. And, you know, that is alarming to me because if I check our servers at night, depending on our guests, we can get up to 11 million downloads for a show. And then I look and see 510 people on YouTube. Now, again, people tell me YouTube takes a long time to build it up. But, you know, do me a favor. Tell your friends, share it, and let them know about the show, if you like the show. You know, I don't believe in the hype that some shows do. I believe when I interview somebody, like we're sitting in the living room and we're having a conversation. That way we get more information. And I think you guys enjoy it. I do it like my friend Art Bell used to do it. And, you know, I'm not trying to copy him because I've been actually doing this now going on 48 years interviewing people. That's a long time. Well, till tomorrow, you know, make sure you tune in the show. We're live. We're not Memrix. And we're not Facebook Live type of show. Catch us tomorrow. Again, check out our website at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. Everybody, you have a good one, and we will catch you on the other side of the campground.